Hey everybody, Paul here. This episode is a very late release. There was some technical difficulties and I thought we were going to have to re-record this, but with some patience and diligence and a few late nights, I was able to recover the files. But because of the late release, we do talk about some topics that are a bit out of date. So sorry about that and sorry for the long delay, but we are going to have a quick turnaround on the next episode later this week. Again, thank you for your patience, and I hope you enjoy the episode. I guess we're ready.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
That's me. I'm Brian Reese. Good to see you.
Well, we can't actually
see each other. See you.
Yeah, this is a fully audio medium.
Good to hear you.
It is good to hear you. Join
all of our loyal fans out there.
Hey, we actually do have some loyal fans, and I want to give a shout out to all of you. I hate the term shout out, and I say it all the time.
What else do you say?
I want to acknowledge publicly all the people out there.
That sounds good.
Okay. So today on the program, we'll be discussing Moon Knight from the Dead, the 2014 six-issue arc written by Warren Ellis with art by Declan Shalvey. Before we do that, I want to mention, do a few mentions here. First of all, we will obviously only be discussing one story arc about Moon Knight, and I am not a Moon Knight expert, but I know some people who are. If you're interested in the character of Moon Knight, give a listen to Into the Night, a Moon Knight podcast. Host Ray and Connor delve deep into the history and lore of the character and give some really good insight into the intricacies on the various runs over the years. It's good stuff.
Neat.
Yeah, it's
I'm
good stuff.
Check that out. Yeah.
Highly recommend it, and I'll be playing the trailer at the break. Also, if you stick around to the end of the show, as a bonus, we'll be playing some Moon Knight related music.
Will we then?
Yes. That's a song by the band called Deleter. And their latest EP, The Other Void, consists of songs based on this run of Moon Knight. I think it's pretty cool. And I'm going to put all their information into the show notes of this episode. And so that if you like the song, you can help out some independent artists.
Always a good thing to do.
That's right.
Pay money directly to the artists is always the best thing.
Absolutely. And now, there is something happening in the world of comics that we'd like to talk about. Now, Brian, I've been talking a lot, so I'm going to let you take the lead on this one.
So if folks, so creators' rights is always a very fascinating issue. And we may even touch on creators' rights with the artist on our next podcast. One of the more amusing things I think that I've noticed in the internet's world, there hasn't been a lot of news. I know New York, the big New York City Comic Con is coming up, and everybody's holding off all of their big announcements till then, as they usually do. Short of James Tynion taking over for a short run on Batman after Tom King leaves, and before the next unnamed writer takes over, there's that little piece of news, but. I think I and others have been watching with great amusement the sad saga of Youngblood.
Yeah.
not to go into too much legalese because I'm not a lawyer, but apparently Rob Liefeld and his feet lost.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof, lost, like it's at some point, Rob Liefeld, right, he lost control of Youngblood and several of his other creator-owned properties.
With blood in the title.
All with blood in the title and pouches and shoulder pads. So he lost the right somehow through some weird, shady business. It's all out there on the internet. You can go to your favorite comic book site. You've probably already read about this little bit of kookiness. But if not, he lost the rights to Youngblood to some guy named Andrew Rev, who had been somehow involved in Comico, I think, back in the day. And let's really take us back.
Something to do with Malibu Comics as well.
Or maybe it was Malibu. I wanted to say Comico, but maybe Malibu makes more sense.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Malibu, yeah.
but we could fact check this.
Or, no, why would we do that?
So apparently there is this company, Terrific Productions, run ostensibly by Andrew Rev, who are attempting to revitalize or reboot or republish Youngblood.
Yeah, it seems like they're going to do a new... Well, actually, I know that from what I looked up, there's going to be Youngblood Unchained.
Right. Well, they have the title. Apparently, they don't have writers or artists for it yet.
Well, there was a tweet that said, writers must swear a blood oath, cloaked top secret. Which says to me, yeah, we haven't written anything. We have no clue.
Right. So what has ensued is a great amount of hilarity between both with Rob Liefeld reacting to all of this and with this Terrific Productions and their tweet. It's hard for me to recommend following Terrific Productions.
You don't have to follow them. You can just go on and take a look, which is what I did.
Just go on and take a look. The tweets are hilarious. They're planning on giving young and up and coming writers such as Brian Wood and Alan Moore some potential exposure if they wanted to sign on.
At one point, now I don't know if this is unsubstantiated or not, but Liefeld apparently said that Rev contacted him and said if he works on the book, he could make him the next big thing in comics. It's like, that is, what kind of bizarre through the looking glass world are we living in?
Well, there's numerous tweets by this company, like tweeting at various artists and writers promising that very thing.
Yeah.
And all of these writers and artists that they're tweeting at are very well established, very well known writers and artists. And it makes me wonder how much of this is performance art.
Yeah, it must. It's got to be. There are some really bizarre, strangely worded tweets that they've put out. My personal favorite is, we're so very happy that we've become the Princess Markle that all self-appointed comic bitches attack.
I mean, how much of that is just hashtagging? How much of that is just is for trending purposes? But at the same time, it's been fun to watch Rob Liefeld's head explode a little bit at all of this.
Yeah, I'm so torn. Sometimes I feel sorry for him, and sometimes after, you know, you watch some of his reactions and you're like, okay, dude, settle down. I do kind of feel bad for Liefeld. I mean, yeah. Liefeld, potato, potato. And we get back to that creator's rights thing, and that's what Image was.
I think that's where it gets, yeah.
Yeah, that's what Image was all about. That he could own those characters, and somewhere along the line, and again, I don't know the legal stuff behind it, but he sold the shares of Youngblood, which was essentially the flagship franchise for Image for a while there.
Yeah.
And you know, the whole company rested on those gigantic shoulders.
Yeah. So gigantic.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole point was for him to have those characters to, you know, creator owned and created and owned.
I mean, and it's weird though, because Youngblood wasn't part of the. Youngblood's not that good. It's a knockoff.
Youngblood's awful. I'm sorry. Youngblood is just not good.
It was a knockoff to begin with.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, people forget, like, as great as Image is now and has been for a good while, when Image first launched, it was bad. It was selling millions of copies of comics, but it was all like, it was all. How do I say this without pissing off half of the comics crowd? It was very, it was named Image for a reason.
Yeah.
And it was all art and no quality.
Well, yeah. And it was very derivative of other franchises and other companies.
Yeah. And so it's not like Youngblood is this hot property that I'm sure people look back on and fondly now. And I apologize to anyone out there for whom Youngblood is their very favorite comic of all time, but
if so, terrible. I'm not gonna say that somebody's tastes are bad. Right. If you like that, you like that. I personally don't like Youngblood. I should just say that.
But for a company to use Youngblood as a potential launching point, minus the creator, and I'm not even sure like Rob Liefeld being involved in it anymore would cause much of a ripple.
Well, you could get that nostalgia thing going on. You know, Liefeld doing a new Youngblood, yay!
Sure,
yeah. Well,
but it is when it goes back to, you know, the concept of a creator owning their own work and how difficult that has been over the years, and only recently have we seen contracts that have been at least semi-positive towards creator ownership. I mean, it took DC and Marvel till recent history to even acknowledge, like, who Superman and Spider-Man, well, a little better with the Stan Lee stuff with Marvel, but it took, you know, till recently for a lot of the big name comic book companies to actually even acknowledge the creators. And even then you had some fights over like certain creators being left out of the acknowledgement.
Well, it's all money. I mean, it just comes down to the comic book companies, be it DC, Marvel, whoever, they wanted all the profits and they considered these artists and writers to be work for hire. You created that for me.
Right. It's like working in an advertising company, essentially. I mean, right. you create for the company, and maybe you get nominated for a Clio or what have you, or, you know, but even, you know, even the erstwhile Don Draper, his creations were always owned by the company he worked for and the company that he was creating the ads for. They were not owned by him.
Exactly. So that's how Marvel and DC saw it. But of course, we know this is an artistic achievement. Creating these characters and creating these and writing these stories, that is literature. I know there's a lot of people who don't believe that comic books are literature, but you know, I'm not one of them. And it should be treated as such. It does get a little dicey, I understand. Now, before I say this, I am fully on board with creator-owned, and creators should have the rights to their characters. But when you have serialized storytelling like this, and you have a character that goes on for 40 years, written by multiple different people and drawn by multiple different people,
it gets tricky.
It does get tricky of like, how, where does the profit go, and who gets? You know, I'm going to use Man-Thing as an example here, just because, you know, Man-Thing wasn't created by Steve Gerber, but Steve Gerber made the character important, and everything you think of was Steve Gerber. So it's a little dicey. You know, when you think of Man-Thing, you think of Steve Gerber.
Well, I had jokes, but we'll just...
Believe me, I've made those jokes so many times.
Yes. But yeah, right. You have certain runs of that are more seminal, and particularly when you change, you know, the nature of a character in a very major way. Yeah, I mean, it's hard. But at the same time, those are known. Like, you know, like when you're working on a company-owned property, you know, the idea is that you come into this knowing full well that you are creating a particular, every character you create is then owned by the company. I get that. I don't, others can quibble with that, but I kind of get that. In some ways, I understand how that works, even if I don't always agree. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you know, Bob Finger created Batman, never saw a dime of it. A little bit of profit.
He was paid for, Siegel and Schuster.
Siegel and Schuster. No, and I get the fact that when a character is created for, say, DC or Marvel, that Marvel gets to continue to use that character. At the same time, the creator should be able to get a little bit of profit from that.
Absolutely. And I think that's where, you know, where I think a lot of the bad feelings come into play. And you know, like, look at, I think part of the reason Vertigo ended up folding is because DC was still owning those characters. They were owning the rights to, you know, the Vertigo creations, which were not in continuity. But, you know, then you had Image, who was offered a way more attractive deal to creators in terms of ownership of their characters and ownership of their properties, that good writers and good artists were like, well, why would I go to Vertigo? Vertigo was great in its time. You know, now there's another company. And it's not just Vertigo. It's a lot of like these smaller companies are doing the same thing, or Image. But Image is kind of like was the shining light for a while, let's say. And so why would you not take your property to Image as opposed to Vertigo?
And I, you know, and cynically, I think that the DC Black Label is just a way for DC to do Vertigo, but still have complete ownership of all those characters.
Oh, right. Because I think Hellblazer, the new Hellblazer, is going to be under Black Label.
Right.
I think all of the Vertigo reissues are now going to be under, you know, the Vertigo trades are going to like have a Black Label stamp on them.
Right. So it's just a kind of an underhanded way not to have to pay your creators as much as you used to, you know.
And I know Marvel tried that a little bit with Max.
Yeah.
And I don't know how Max, I don't, it was so minor.
Max was minor?
It was, yes. But Max was minor in so many ways. I think there was some Punisher stuff and whatever, but it never made the same impact that Vertigo did or some of these others. So I don't, you know, it's harder to research like what ownership creators had within Max, but you know, the Punisher stuff, there's no way Garth Ennis owned the Punisher suddenly because it was published under Max.
Oh yeah. Well, no, but that was a legacy character.
Brubaker maintained control of Casanova. I think Matt Fraction still owns Casanova, which was it originally published under Max, or did it start at Image, move to Max, and then when Fraction left, did it go back to Image?
I really can't tell you.
I can't remember. But you know, there's Casanova was in there somewhere too with Matt Fraction's Casanova.
But again, that was an original character as opposed to like Punisher. He was pulling that in from the main continuity.
All of this to say, like, it's the whole Rob Liefeld. We're not answering questions. But I just think it's really it really shows how interesting the comics world still is in terms of ownership of your creations. And I think the Rob Liefeld, like you said, there is a little sympathy for him on this. I mean, something he created is now owned by somebody else and is going to be controlled potentially going forward by somebody else, regardless whether that property is any good or anyone's interested in the property. And regardless of whatever bad business decisions Rob Liefeld made, you know, he's not the first big name creator to sign what many view as a bad contract that has allowed their seminal important work in comics to be, you know, used by a large comic book company.
That's sort of the nature of comics. I mean, the thing that makes this unique is the fact that both Liefeld and this Andrew Rev have just been making fools of themselves in public. And it's just kind of silly.
And none of it leading towards, you know, none of this makes me want to pick up. Like, I wouldn't have picked up Youngblood when Rob Liefeld wrote it, and Rob Liefeld was probably the only draw on Youngblood to begin with. So, I mean, unless they get, you know, disgraced comic book writer Brian Wood or something like that in to write it, you know, what in the world is the attraction to this property? Minus the one person who drew people to it to begin with, no pun intended.
Exactly. So, it looks like Rob Liefeld was defeated.
Oh, I can't believe I haven't run into that before. I think you might be the first that I've seen that from.
Well, I hope so. I'm going to copyright that so that I get.
Yeah, you should. Well, you know, make sure we get this out there. Well done, young man.
Thank you very much. So on that note, I think we should take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Moon Knight.
Sounds good.
Hey, Ray.
Yes, Connor.
What's black and white and red all over?
A newspaper?
Not even close.
A sunburnt zebra?
What are you doing, Ray? Not even close.
Into the Night, a Moon Knight podcast. A weekly podcast coming to you from the High Priest of Khonshu. Available on all good podcast catchers.
And we're back! Hey, Paul!
Hey, Brian!
So we're back!
We are back.
We are, and I believe that today the comic book collection in question is based on your recommendation. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, I do. Moon Knight, aka Mark Spector, is a Jewish rabbi's son, former heavyweight boxer, U.S. Marine, mercenary, and occasional CIA subcontractor who was betrayed and killed on a mission but was revived by the worshippers of an ancient Egyptian god called Khonshu, who makes him an avatar on Earth, imbuing him with otherworldly power. Spectre then uses that power to become a vigilante to stop crime. You know, like you do. Also, he's a billionaire, has dissociative identity disorder, and all of this may or may not be real because he's insane. Yeah, his backstory is a little complicated. Now, over the years, different creative teams have had multiple takes on Moon Knight and whether he is possessed by a supernatural entity who dresses in white and fights bad guys, or if he's just a crazy person who thinks he's possessed by a supernatural entity, dresses in white, and fights bad guys. Well, in 2014, Warren Ellis was brought on to take over the character with a new ongoing title. In this 6-issue run, Ellis plays with the idea of the tri-personality of Mark Spector, clearly distinguishing Moon Knight into 3 distinct personalities. The violent vigilante superhero readers were familiar with, a more refined white suit-clad detective, Mr. Knight, and a full-on magical avatar of an Egyptian god complete with bird skeleton outfit. Using these personas, Ellis was able to tell 3 different types of stories, that of the traditional superhero, a police procedural, and a supernatural horror tale. He, along with great art by Declan Shalvey and outstanding colors by Jordi Belair, were able to weave these distinct types of stories into short vignettes that tie into one another and tell a complicated, disturbing, yet compelling tale of violence and madness with just a little heroism thrown in for good measure. And in doing so, they gave Moon Knight what he so desperately needed, a direction. Brian, what did you think of Moon Knight from the Dead?
Is that the name of the collection? From the Dead, okay.
Yeah.
I just read the individual issues. I think you said a couple things spot on. First of all, we could talk for hours and hours about Shalvey's art and Jordi Belair's colors. Mm-hmm. Jordi Belair, I think, is maybe one of the, if not the best colorist in the business. Certainly one of.
I do want to address that because yeah. we don't really acknowledge or give that much credit to colorists and inkers. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So Warren Ellis is one of my very favorite comic writers. You know, I mean, we all make lists. Lists are popular and fun, and we love lists. And when you do lists of like your top 5 favorite comic book writers, the list would change daily depending on my mood or one's mood or what have you. But I think Warren Ellis would always be somewhere in the top 5, if not the top 3 consistently. So I remember when this came out, I was very excited. Moon Knight was a character that I was always a little bit iffy on. I mean, the great run with Doug Mensch, I'm not sure if I'm saying his name correctly, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which I was actually surprised that's not where we went with Moon Knight. But, you know, that was a great run. It was an incredible run. But subsequent and previous runs on Moon Knight, I didn't follow very closely. And you know, I mean, we're not going to say the Marvel Batman, so I won't.
you already said it.
Oh, that's right. But so it was intriguing to me when this comic first came out. And I was like, that was a time when it was like, if Warren Ellis was writing it, I was buying it. And yeah. I certainly didn't really know anything about Declan Shalvey at that point. I think this is one of the comics that kind of helped make his reputation. You know, I bought up those issues. And of course, the Warren Ellis, it was only meant to be 6 issues. So that's all Warren Ellis wrote. It was a 6 issue,
right.
Basically starter pack, let's call it, to a further ongoing Moon Knight.
Yeah, and Jeff Lemire eventually took over and did a very good job as well, yeah.
And, you know, Brian Wood took over after that, yeah. comics writer Brian Wood took over after that with some great work by Smallwood, Greg Smallwood, I think. Yes. One of the things going back and reading this again is I when I was reading these six issues, and we should note that these six issues are essentially one and dones. Each issue is contained and tells a singular story. Now it's all part of a larger story.
Right, I was going to say that.
And a larger idea, but there at the end of each issue, there's no to be continued. There's no cliffhanger.
The
case is solved at the end of each issue, and the next issue is a new case, let's say.
Exactly.
One of the things that struck me about this is how very Raymond Carver these stories were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how apt that is as a comparison, but...
No, I think it's absolutely...
Raymond Carver, very famously, his stories would start in the middle of the story. Raymond Carver's the short story format. His stories would basically start in the middle of the story and end before the story was really over. And there was an economy of writing and an economy of explanation in his writing. This isn't a literary podcast. Well, it is a literary podcast, but it's not.
Yeah.
So, we could talk for hours about Raymond Carver. But that it's part of the appeal of these particular six issues is like someone did Raymond Carver as a comic.
That's a fantastic analogy or comparison, I guess would be a better word. It's exactly right in tone and feel and mood. It's all Raymond Carver,
which is very unique for Warren Ellis in some ways.
Is it?
Warren Ellis does do economy, but he also does the.
But he has sort of a noir feel often,
right?
Which is Carver-esque. I think the reason you asked why I chose this one, because this one I really feel that, has the way we're seeing Moon Knight today, and I'm assuming what we're going to see on the TV show when it's eventually launched, is this. This is what I mean, the way Moon Knight is presented right here. What I tried to do in the synopsis, in that beginning little snarky synopsis, was to show that this character was sort of kicked around to various creators, and each and everybody else had their own take on it. There was no real consistent, this is who Moon Knight is.
Definitely one of the most inconsistently written.
Right. I mean, and there's some really great runs and really good stuff, but you can't really say this is who Moon Knight is.
Right.
In the same way you can say, even with all the varied Batmans, you can tell, you know who Batman is.
Right. I think some writers there's always been a difficulty in embracing the metaphysical aspect.
Well, yeah. And some people jettison it completely. Some people embrace it. But then you get Ellis right here. So Ellis is just sort of taking everything that came before and he's sort of putting it together in his own way and saying, this is it. This is the template. Go forth and prosper. Yeah. And he sort of embraces the metaphysical while still leaving that door open for, is he really crazy?
Well, and he toes a nice line between that. Like you said, you mentioned noir a few minutes ago, and there is a very strong noirish feel to this. These are procedurals.
Oh, yeah.
Each of these individual stories are essentially procedurals that, and definitely tone-wise, darker. He sets himself up as the defender of what the travelers, the night travelers, the travelers at night. So
yeah, he's the watcher of overnight travelers.
Yeah, there we go. And so I think Ellis does a really good job of mixing the various takes on Moon Knight and kind of coalescing them into a better whole than we have seen from a lot of other writers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the character is very consistent here and in a way very subtle because, like I said, he still leaves that door open for the insanity aspect of it.
Which was followed up, I believe, more strongly by subsequent writers.
Yes, because, who needs subtlety when you could just go crazy? Literally.
Which is, and maybe when I said earlier in terms of Ellis showing with his style, like showing some restraint, because mm-hmm. Warren Ellis does a lot of drugs. I don't want to get sued here. So Warren Ellis has spoken in the past of doing a lot of.
Yes, he himself has admitted to the fact that he does a lot of drugs.
And so I don't wish to say that currently Warren Ellis is off his rocker on, But and sometimes in his storytelling, that in the same way with Grant Morrison, you see too, is tending to go a little bit off into the more esoteric worlds. And he, with the exception of one particular story, the sleep story, Ellis tends to keep things very grounded.
Yes, and that works really well for the character of Moon Knight. I mean, the street level gritty crime aspect of this, where he's doing actual detective work, and then he's still battling some supernatural elements and some, you know, larger than life characters. But it's really, really, like you said, it's really grounded into the street life of New York, and that suits Moon Knight so well.
Yeah, and it was great to see him train, because he had been in L.A. before this, and
yeah,
and I get kind of why they did that, but returning him to New York just felt right.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, the L.A. run, that was Bendis, I believe, back in your Bendis days. You know, he tried to make Moon Knight's other personalities actual superheroes.
Right.
Like, it was Spider-Man, Captain America, and Wolverine.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting idea, but like I said, Ellis just knows, he took what really works with Moon Knight, to me. What really works with Moon Knight is that gritty urban feel, and New York is the best setting for that.
And it's Ellis was doing some interesting things at this time too. It's not just with Moon Knight, but like what he did, like 6 or 7 or 8 issues with Dark Avengers.
Yes, I have not read that. So I
around can't. This time as yeah. well, where it was an intentionally limited run that he was doing. And again, like these were, if I remember correctly, these were self-contained stories too. And so this seemed to be a thing that Ellis was working on during that sort of 5 or 6 year period. So.
I think it suits him to know that he has limits and a contained story arc, basically.
Well, it's a lot better than his other tendency, which is to start long, complicated stories.
Yes.
Gilead Image, and then just not finish. Looking at you, Dr. Sleepless.
So do you want to talk about each individual story? There's only 6 of them, and they, like you said, they're pretty contained,
right?
Each one.
There are, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, that'd be, each one has its own story. We don't have to go into great detail about each one, but it does have elements that carry over to the next one as far as how the character is advancing. There, it does tell an overarching story, or I guess emotional arc. For
it's the more of an emotional arc, or more of a setup in terms of who mm-hmm. he is now and how he reacts to various situations.
Right.
Each story, like the actual mystery or what have you, doesn't necessarily tie into.
With the exception of the first and last stories.
Right. The first and last story, it's a neat little trick he does.
Yes.
I think the best issue in this run by far for me was the second issue, Sniper.
Sniper. Oh, I do want to, yeah.
And we have to talk about that, like, in the, and for me, it's part of that is structure.
Absolutely. Let's get to that.
And art. The weakest story to me was the next one, Box. Which, if you could explain to me what that was about, that would be great.
Okay, well, first of all, I think that, you know, what Ellis is doing here is he's taking each of the personalities and he's allowing it, he's telling a different story, a different type of story in each issue. Like in Slasher, the very first story, it's basically just a police procedural.
Right.
Straight up, Moon Knight is Law and Order. You could picture him walking away from that scene with dun-dun.
Mr. Knight.
So that's when he's in his dapper white suit and he's showing some of his detecting skills. He gets to work with the cops and dress down a kind of a belligerent cop, which will come back to haunt him. But, you know, and then
he does a neat trick with his moonerang.
Yes, he does. I do, you know, I like the fact that he's in a giant white limousine with his logo on it. You know, not really undercover.
No,
but that's sort of the, you know,
that thematically is important throughout the series as well. He continually talks about, and other people talk about, how he wants to be seen.
Yes, that's why he wears all stark white.
Right. Numerous references to, like, you know, how you work at night yet you're wearing all white. It's like, you know, you're going to be seen by, and he's like, yes, that's the point.
Yeah, he wants to scare. You know, he wants people to see him coming so he can scare the crap out of them. So, and then of course the villain of that story is really deeply troubling. It turns out to be this ex-agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. who is trying to make himself, quote, better by giving himself medical enhancements. And it's just this creepy ass thing where he's grafted a sword to his arm. And yeah,
he's killing people to take their body parts.
Yes. So it's kind of a Frankenstein's monster. So it's this police procedural, which, you know, has elements of horror to it. All these stories have elements of horror to them, but it's, you know, it's very disturbing. But at the same time, there's some visual elements to this that are great. Like when Moon Knight is going down through the manhole and you're seeing all the different levels of New York, it's really, the visual storytelling in this is outstanding.
In all of these, we'll get on.
So that, you know, and that this one sort of sets the stage and lets us see who Moon Knight is, and more, he's more than just some violent vigilante. He begins to show you one of his aspects and lets you, and then, like I said, sets the stage for the future issues.
It also establishes him as kind of a dick.
Well, yeah, that's actually been fairly consistent with Mark Spector from the very beginning. He's not a very pleasant man. But so in the second issue, Sniper, this one's really brutal, but the way it's depicted is amazing.
Yeah, and I was debating with myself over how to describe what he does, what is done, and whether I should describe what he does.
Well, I'm gonna.
Okay. Yeah. it's your baby.
Yeah. So there's an 8-panel layout. This, in the beginning, the way this is, so there's a sniper picking off people, and it's depicted in an eight panel layout, showing the victims, and then their impending death, and then the victim that's going to be shot is a completely red panel, which gets back to the coloring again, and we got to talk about that. And then as it moves along, the victim that has been killed, that panel has been removed.
Right. This is over 8 pages.
Eight pages or nine pages.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as it progresses, there's more and more empty space.
So each page is an 8-panel grid.
Right. And this is a very clever use of visual storytelling. There's a real sense of dread as this sequence progresses, as people are removed from the page. The panel is removed, so there's just white space there. That person's dead and gone.
And white space and negative space is such a big part of this whole series. But go on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and this gets back to kind of a running theme on this program. This can only be done in comics. This kind of, you know, it's not cinematic. It's not just something you can do in prose. This is visually showing you, it's visually removing people from the space of the page.
But doing it by space rather than, and so in each of these panels, as it's starting off, we're getting some history of the people where we're hearing their dialogue, and each one has a different story, and they all seem very non-connected. As each page goes on, like their voice is silenced, as so is their image, and so is their presence, and replaced by the negative space until you're down to, so you have 8 panels, and then there's 8 panels, but only 7 with any pictures, and then vice versa. So yeah. Anyway, sorry, I wouldn't want to do.
Well, no, it's really quite clever and brilliant the way that it's done. Yeah, this was easily, again, like you said, this was definitely my favorite of the 6 stories, just because of how it's presented. The end is fairly straightforward. You get a little bit of a Warren Ellis flexing his political social justice warrior credentials at the end.
Right.
Because all these people are now working to help the banks.
Yeah, there's a small twist at the end. It's not a major twist, but it's not something you really see coming, because you're not used to how Ellis is telling these stories yet, because all of these stories, all 6 of these, end very abruptly.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And you know, it leaves more story to be told, but it ends abruptly. And I think it's also important to note that in the first 2 stories, both of the antagonists were abandoned soldiers.
Yes,
And Mark Spector had been a soldier as well. So I think thematically there's a reason that Ellis was doing that a little bit. It's very interesting that he did it in the first 2 concurrent stories. But
and you get a little bit again at the end as well with his doppelganger. But we'll get to that.
Right.
The next story, Box, I kind of like this one because it's just a proper ghost story. So in the first story, you see Mr. Knight, the detective. In the second story, Sniper, there's Moon Knight the superhero in his full costume garb using his gadgets.
And long and pages and pages of no dialogue and just action.
Yeah, really great stuff with his cape, that huge cape expanding out and having him glide in the night.
Right.
Yeah, really beautiful stuff. The what?
Nothing. Carry on.
But in this third one, we get to see the supernatural aspect where he has to dress up in a skeleton bird costume, which I love, by the way. I think
it looks awesome.
Yeah, it does. And it's like I said, it's a proper ghost story. You have punks that are ghosts beating up people on the street. And it's an interesting take that the ghosts can physically hurt people, like physically cause pain and damage while not being able to be touched themselves. That's a neat little twist on the standard, you know, haunting. But Moon Knight has to embrace his supernatural side in order to punch ghosts.
Right.
Which is neat. You know, how many superheroes punch ghosts?
And you have everything.
Yeah. So it's like so Ellis sets up in the first three issues the different aspects of who Moon Knight is. And then we can combine them all for the last three. Do you have any more to say about Box?
I only in that the cautionary thing is I don't exactly know what happened at the end. And it may not be important for me to. That's basically my only quibble was this story and the end. And the end is actually keeping in what I've complimented it for in the rest of the series, which is it just ends. And you're left kind of trying to figure things out. But there's something about the ending of this one that just irritated me a little bit. And it was only the ending. The rest of the comic is great. You know, it's one of those weird things where I'm happy to let the mystery be in most things, but for some reason I felt like this one was a little cheap, and that's just me, probably.
I don't know. It was a magical box which caused the spirits to be trapped, basically, and I think it's sort of a riff on addiction. You know,
right?
These people are trapped in their own box and can't escape it, and they're continually doing violence to themselves and others. It's not a particularly a new idea, original, but I think it was done with a little panache, and again, visually stunning.
Looked great.
Yeah. So the next one, if you want to talk about visually stunning, Moon Knight has to find out why there's crazy stuff happening in a particular area. To cut to the chase, apparently there's a dead man under the floorboards of an apartment that has mystical mushrooms growing in his forehead, which causes...
Right. So he had some kind of floral...
Psychedelic death shrooms.
Right. Like in his head, some kind of infection, and then was killed by...
By someone doing research on sleep disorder.
Right.
In a questionable test.
But this is the one where Warren Ellis got to get kooky and got to let Shalvey like go all, you know.
Now this is some Doctor Strange type of stuff.
Right. Or yeah. I even thought of even going back to like some of the underground comics of the 60s.
For sure.
All of the psychedelic sort of imagery. And of course, a lot of those weren't done in color, whereas with this, we have the popping colors and whatever. But he goes full on Morrison here.
Yes, he does. This is really good. It reminded me of some of the more trippy Magneto stories in Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. Those are the two things that I thought of. Really just great playing with layout and dimension and space, plus with all the trippy colors.
Right. It's the drug issue, basically. It's the psychedelics drug issue.
Mm-hmm. It's quite good.
Yeah.
The next issue is Scarlet, which is there's a young girl who's kidnapped and kept in an apartment building on the top floor. Moon Knight has to fight his way up. It's basically the raid or game of death where he has to fight his way to the top.
It's a video game. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, again, very, very brutal. There is some
excessively. I mean, this is where they just let loose, and the amount of ways they come up with that Ellis and Shalvey come up with to inflict
pain and injury,
to inflict pain and violence on people is stunning. It hurts to read and look at. But this is another one where there's very little dialogue.
Well, you don't really need it. He's just crushing people.
He's literally just he's in a hotel moving up levels and meeting you know, the next stage of difficulty.
Yeah, until he finally gets to the big boss. And again, very traditionally structured. This is not something that hasn't been done before, but very unique in the way that it's presented and executed. This is an example of violence done well.
if we would be so bold as to condone such a thing.
Yes. Yeah, so I don't want to see this in real life, but at the same time, it's interesting to see on a page.
Yeah.
The last story is Spectre, which ties up the first story, that the police officer who in the beginning was dressed down by both his superior and by Mr. Knight begins to become obsessed with Moon Knight and wants to replicate who he is for his own ego and that he has a family. Essentially, he goes crazy being obsessed by Moon Knight, and Moon Knight shuts him down. But
it's a neat. Oh, I'm go sorry. Ahead.
No. Go. What you were going to say?
It's a neat. The issue is a neat framing device from the first issue.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Structurally, it's fantastic. I like this because I took from this. The very last line is he never. You know, the reason the other guy lost is because he had a family and that he had things to protect. Whereas Moon Knight does not have those things, and he actually says, "I never want to be loved." Now, this is taking the idea of Batman. Now, you know, you can't get away from the fact that Moon Knight and Batman are tied to each other. I mean, it's Marvel's Batman is Moon Knight. That's right. Just what it is. Now, I think, you know, we can talk about how it's presented and executed, and their stories that they're very different characters, but essentially that's how he was created. Now, I think that Ellis was taking the idea of Batman to its logical end. He is a lone vigilante, and the more people he has around him, you know, the softer he gets. Tom King has been playing with that in his current Batman run, and many authors have. You know, Batman's supposed to be this lone, brooding, solitary figure, but he has a hell of a lot of people around him, whereas Moon Knight does not.
And the final issue also does a really great job of showing some of his former associates.
Yes.
And Frenchy and the others, and why they are no longer associate with him, or why they are no longer part of the Moon family. Is that right? If we have the Bat family, is it the Moon family?
The Moon family?
The Sunny Moon family?
Moon family? Yeah, I don't know. Moon Knighters? Moonies? Moonies. Let's go with Moonies.
We'll just go with Moonies. Someone else may have a claim on that, but we'll go with that anyway.
Yes. By the way, Frenchy, the character's name is Jean-Paul Duchamp, which is... Somebody was taking an art class in the 70s.
Yeah,
I'm an art major. Yeah, see, I was an art major with a minor in philosophy. So Jean-Paul Duchamp, I get that completely. That's what I would have come up with in college as well. So all of these stories, again, are told simply, but they're told well. They're simple stories that are told really, really visually stunning. And Ellis just has that little unique storytelling flair that he can really punch you in the gut with emotion, or with, you know, with that visceral.
Right. And some of it, like, we haven't even touched really on the dialogue, except like the last line that we both kind of quoted at the same time from the sixth. I mean, it's Ellis. You kind of know what you're going to get with Ellis, and he's good enough that he'll flip things around a little bit.
Yeah. Ellis at his worst is still pretty good, but when he's on, boy, that's something to really cherish.
And that's why I kind of like this, you know, his six and done, intended six and done. It forces him to edit himself, which sometimes he has trouble with, which good writers do, especially when they're people with ideas. And Warren Ellis is definitely a person with ideas.
For sure.
I feel like I should do that in a Terry Pratchett voice, you know.
He's a person.
It's all capitalized. A person with ideas.
Yeah. But this is, you know, there's a lot of ideas. There's a lot of thoughts here. There's a lot of, you know, I touched on it briefly in the sniper thing where he has a message that he's trying to get across. Sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's not.
But he does it in such a wonderfully spare manner. And yes. I think that's, I know I'm kind of repeating myself on that, although using, but it is, it's very spare.
Yeah.
Like in terms of his presence is not felt as strongly as Shelby's is. And by me saying that, that is not a negative.
No, it's intentional. It's definitely intentional.
It is intentional. And when I talk about presence, I don't mean that, you know, some of the best, you know, it's the best films are when you don't notice the direction. The best acting performances are when you don't notice the actors. I get all that. And I'm not trying to, like, say that the writer or the artist's presence needs to be felt over the story. But at the end of the day, the writer is a presence. And in comics, the writer and the artists are presence, whether, you know, in terms of crafting the story.
Yes. So, no, absolutely. And I tend to...
That was a lot of mea culpas there.
No, I absolutely. I mean, I'm very guilty of this because of my background and what interests me. I tend to focus on the writer and the artist. And I tend to push kind of the other things aside. For instance, and I want to talk about Jordi Belair. You know, like I said before, I don't talk much about colorists because it's not really my expertise and I don't feel like I can speak to it in a way that, you know, will do it justice or add anything right. significant other than it's pretty. That being said, I do understand and acknowledge the importance of color to the comic and those who color. But every once in a while, there's something that is so good that it's undeniable and evident even to someone like me. Mm-hmm. And Jordi Belair's work just elevates everything she works on.
Everything.
Yeah. Everything. I mean, she makes good comics great and great comics classics.
Yeah.
I mean, her work on Vision and Hawkeye, she's doing the new Buffy, which is really good. If you're into Buffy, go check that out. And her work here is pivotal to creating the atmosphere and tone.
Absolutely.
I was really blown away.
It doesn't stand out as you're not looking at it saying this is different from the rest. It serves the story so perfectly.
Absolutely. Just you know, the most evident thing that she does is the stark black and white from Moon Knight. You know, how it almost seems like he's detached from the rest of the scene because he's just colorless.
Yes. And again, it's like I think I mentioned before, that's that negative space usage.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And her choices of where to make it drab and where to make it vibrant, they're just perfect. They're spot on. There's in addition to the black and white for Moon Knight himself, there's the vivid reds of blood, you know, all the paisley psychedelia for the trippy death mushroom thing.
Right.
Even just mundane office lighting for a mundane office scene. It's perfect. It fits the story. You know, it adds an extra level of feeling to the story. Because the art itself is great. Chauvelet's art is fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, Ellis really gave Chauvelet and Belair a chance to basically give a clinic on sequential art. And it's now there is a good reason possibly why Jordi Belair and Chauvelet work so well together, or Chauvelet works so well together.
Which is?
They are a couple.
Oh, you know what? I'll admit, I did not know that.
So there you go, kids. This is the Us Weekly portion of the or the TMZ portion of
So they're intimately connected.
Yes, they are. You know, they work well together apparently on many levels.
Okay, I did not know that. Yeah, but this is one of those things. If you took Warren Ellis's writing out of it, and it was just if you just saw the pictures and the colors, holy cow, this is just a gorgeous comic. In a brutal way.
Yeah, you know, and again, it goes back to it. He Ellis allows for that. You mm-hmm. know, again, there are so to reiterate, there are so many pages in this comic that are dialogue free, mm-hmm. but each of those pages is as meaty and important and time consuming to. And by time consuming in a good way to view and read through as if there were every panel had dialogue.
Oh yeah, you can just pore over them and get so much out of every panel. It's very good. And then when you add on top of that, Warren Ellis's tight plotting and sparse storytelling. This, I mean, that's why I chose this over all the other Moon Knight stories. It's just this is just one that, like you said, it's a masterclass in how to do a comic.
Yeah, and you know, thematically, it's tight.
Yes.
You know, and again, it's like you caught something I didn't really catch, which is the stories utilizing each of his sort of personas. Mm-hmm. And I have to be, you know, be honest. I did not really catch that or catch on to that. But then, as you're describing it, I'm like, oh yeah. So that's just another layer where you know, it's, again, it could be another repeat reading. Now, if I would go back and read it again, I would read it with that in mind. And yet again, that would be another take.
Yeah. Yeah. Ellis put some thought into this. He didn't just go in willy-nilly. He thought about what he wanted to say and who the character is. And I think he defined who Moon Knight is moving forward so that future depictions will have this as a starting point.
It seems like a reasonable, it's a really good way to kind of condense his character into, like you said, a more usable character. Now, I haven't read a lot of the stuff going forward. I did read, I think I continued on with this series afterwards, at least through a portion of Lemire's run on it. But again, this comic gets rebooted and canceled so often that it's really tough to keep up with.
It is.
I'm assuming there's another Moon Knight coming when the show drops.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I'm sure there'll be tie-ins and retro releases and whatnot.
Yeah. So I'll be intrigued to see who takes over Moon Knight from there. It seems like Moon Knight is having at least more recently in the last 10, 15 years or so, like the same thing that Daredevil gets where often Daredevil will get some of the premier writers on the title with a couple exceptions recently. But Moon Knight is also like attracting some of the premier names for writers, but yet still can't maintain sales enough to...
No doubt that will change if the MCU's past his prologue. He will probably have a resurgence in popularity. Hell, Guardians of the Galaxy comics are selling now. So, but you're right about Moon Knight getting some premier writers. I mean, you can see how that would be, with the aspect of, because there's violence, but there's also the dual personality aspect and the supernatural elements. And is it real or is it not real? You can see how a writer could really sink their teeth into that.
There are certain characters that just, that attract a higher caliber of writer. And I this isn't to denigrate other writers. You know, there's comic book writers out there that do a great job and what have you. But, I mentioned Moon Knight or I mentioned Daredevil. Batman is one as well. You don't put a, second tier writer on Batman. So I don't know, and it would be nice to see Moon Knight really... I will be curious to see if when the new Moon Knight comes out, if it follows in the trajectory of, like you said, of Warren Ellis and the setup here. You seem to think that will be...
Well, yeah. I mean, you could see how each of these issues could be made into, an episode of television. Mm-hmm. There's start, you have a beginning and an end, and then a larger story arc for the season. But, doing it as a police procedural with a crazy man dressed in white, that makes for a compelling television show. And, TV does not shy away from doing police shows.
No, TV likes the procedural.
Yes. I think we should have a lawyer, doctor, police officer. I think that would be the perfect drama.
Who is a superhero at night.
That's right. That's a superhero name. Lawyer, doctor, cop.
Captain Lawyer, Dr.
Captain
Cop.
Law. That's Dr. Captain Lawyer. All right. So are we done with this?
That's what we have to say. I think we're both recommending this, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I if you haven't read this, go do so, because it's really quite good comics.
Yeah.
All right. So, Brian, the next episode is our it's a big one. It's our 50th episode, and you get to pick the comic.
Oh,
for the big 50. I know. So, what's it going to be?
Well, we have to do something a little special, right, for the big 50, So, Alan Moore is tricky.
We should put that on a t-shirt.
Alan Moore's tricky. there are certain comics that I don't think we will ever cover here, and I think we've mentioned that before, but I don't ever plan on recommending The Watchmen. I don't feel like I have anything new to
for a comic we're never going to talk about. We talk about it a hell of a lot.
We talk about it a lot anyway, but we haven't done Alan Moore yet, and Alan Moore is more than just The Watchmen, and one of my very favorite comic book characters and one of my very favorite comic book runs of all time, of course, is Swamp Thing. And Paul and I, we both share an interest in creatures from swamps.
Yes, yes, we love swamp-based monster characters.
So I think for the big 50, let's do some Alan Moore. I would like to do a Swamp Thing run. I think the difficulty with Swamp Thing is there are so many great arcs and so many great individual issues, and some of the most classic issues are far apart from each other and not included in single arcs. I mean, My Blue Heaven, Rites of Spring, Pog. There's so many great, you know, the issue 37, which is the introduction of John Constantine. So it's very difficult to pick an arc or a collected edition that represents Swamp Thing, and we're not going to do the whole damn run. So
that would be a long issue or a long episode.
That would be a very long episode. So I did settle on one arc that I thought had enough really good stuff and enough points of interest that would be a good intro for us to talk about Swamp Thing. So we're going to do The Murder of Crows, which is Swamp Thing episode or issues 43 through 50. There's a lot of interesting things that happen in this. Some people consider this to be one of his best arcs. Other people will have other favorites, but that's the one I'm settling on. So for the big 50, we are going to talk about Alan Moore and we're going to talk about Swamp.
That's fantastic. This is obviously classic run of comic books. It does tie into my love of swamp-based monster characters.
It's also October.
Yep. There's
is a good thing to talk about in Halloween month.
Yeah, we're going to try to do a whole month of horror and scary related things for our love of Halloween. I'm a big fan of Halloween and Halloween things. So this works out perfectly. So I'm looking forward to that. I think we'll have a lot to say. Yeah,
hopefully.
All right. Well, everybody, thank you all for listening. We do appreciate your comments and your feedback. So please do that on your preferred communication outlet.
On your portable telephones.
That's right. Info on how to do that is in the end tag. And don't forget to stick around because we'll be playing a Moon Knight related song. The song is called Box. And again, it's by the band Deleter off their EP, The Other Void. If you like it, buy their stuff, support indie music. All info will be in the show notes. So until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Payoff goes to me.
So today on the program, we'll be discussing Moon Knight from the Dead, the 2014 six-issue arc written by Warren Ellis with art by Declan Shalvey. Shalvey. I have a feeling I'm going to be slurring over that last name quite a bit. Shalvey. Okay.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, it's just Declan.
Declan.
Yeah.
D-Clan. That's
he's the missing Wu-Tang Clan now, member.
D-Clan. Or it's a half French, half Scottish. D-Clan. Anyway, all this is being cut. And until next time, keep reading comics. And.
Oh, and be well. I forgot my. And Nancy's looking at me going, be well. She knows my final line, and I'm sitting there going, what is it?
Do you want to keep it like that, or do you want to do another take?
Yeah, let's try that again. Just,
okay. So until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
Boom. We got it.
Ooh. I think I had this look of like fear on my face, yeah. And I look over at Nancy and she's mouthing to me, be well.
Yeah. I'm sitting here with my head tilted like a dog waiting like, what's going on? Did I lose you? What happened?
And stand, be good to each other and be safe.
We've only done this 50 times.